You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
In a world filled with cigars, craft beer, comics, movies, and video games,
only two men are brave enough to search out all things nerdy.
It's the Cigar Nerds Podcast!
And welcome to the Cigar Nerds Podcast. I'm your host, Smokin' Joe.
I'm Brad Jackson.
So we're having one of those like two for cigar episodes. So what are you smoking, Brad?
This week I've got the Brick House Maduro.
He's a brick
house. Yep. You know, this is just a classic timeless smoke. I've had the Brick House Maduro, you know, no less than a dozen times. And it's one of those that just continually makes it back into the rotation. Well constructed, you know, medium to full on this guy, you know, earthy, toasty, you know, for some reason we're doing a early morning recording and,
cause yeah, behind the scenes, this is a busy weekend, but we were on the clock and couldn't be late this week. Cause we got a bunch of content that's time sensitive. So this is like the only window of opportunity is too fucking early after a late night last night.
But, I mean, even starting off with a cigar right off the rip, I mean, dude, there's been days that I've started, you know, with like, the Diablos and stuff. And, you know, by afternoon, you know, you definitely got your old man raspy voice going and stuff. So, this is a great one to get the taste buds excited, get some nicotine in your system, and, you know, get your day started caffeinated.
Oh, yeah.
And, it's full of nicotine.
It's kind of funny. Recording this day after, you know, shout out to the cigar shop on their 20th anniversary, but I met Eric Newman. That's a J.C. Newman cigar. So I went to get my picture taken with him, and I'm on my like third cigar of the day by this point. I'm smoking a Punch Signature Series, and I'm like, so I went to get my photo with Eric Newman. I'm like, hey, Mr. Newman, I want to apologize though. I'm not smoking one of your cigars currently, but I did just smoke a Brick House. So I have smoked one of your cigars today. So can I still get a picture? And he's like, yeah, I'm not going to hold that against you. Come on in here. Oh.
Yeah, he wasn't holding it against you right at that moment. But, you know, he's definitely judging you right now.
I was like, I promise, I just smoked a Brick House before this. So I'm good. Well, today I'm smoking a fancy smoke. This is the new CAO Arcana series, the third of that series. This is the Thunder Smoke. And you're kind of legally required to say it that way. It comes from some of the tobacco in this is grown in the shadow of Africa's Victoria Falls, and it's got a bunch of African tobacco in the blend. But the local tribal name for that waterfall is the Smoke That Thunders.
That sounds badass.
Yeah, so this is
Does
Honduran,
it bless the rains?
It does. Honduran Olancho San Agustin wrapper over Mexican San Andreas with fillers from South Africa, Zimbabwe, and Cameroon. And it is a medium to full strength cigar.
Don't see too many Cameroons, you know, floating around. At least not that make it to...
I usually see it like some rapper stuff.
Yeah.
Like some Ecuadorian Cameroon. But yeah.
And I completely bricked on the Brick House. So this is all Nicaraguan everything. You know, rapper, binders, fillers. And I got to say, pairing this with some mocha, the little bit of, you know, coca that you get from this pairs wonderfully with the coffee,
whether it's canned or hot.
I'm not a hot coffee drinker, like and realistically I'm not.
I am in the mornings, like
I'm not a big coffee drinker just in general. Like I'm not the one that's like, oh shit, I'm awake, I gotta start my day with a cup of coffee, you know.
I'm coffee in the morning, energy drinks in the afternoon. but I'm not,
I don't even know the
drink,
last time like, I had an energy drink.
Coffee,
like I've been
throughout the day,
trying so hard to cut out, you know, bread, sugar, and shit. Like, and each time I get on the scale, like, you know, I'm like, okay, you know, like, I'm not an uber fat ass like I once was. But, you know, I did let myself creep back up to a couple hundred pounds, and now I'm back in, like, the low 180s. So, you know, kind of the 170 is my goal.
You got to hit the gym, man. Pack on some muscle, man. Just get fucking yoked.
Yeah, with my work schedule?
Yeah, the same thing. It's like, fuck, I barely make it to class at this point.
My job is a gym.
Well, speaking of yoked, we're going to talk about some aliens this week. We're talking about the new alien Romulus. And then we're also going to kind of have a Dragon Con hangover episode, because we still got a whole bunch of interviews that we recorded at Dragon Con to drop on you the second half of this episode. So with that, also get your energy drinks. If you've got to fight aliens, StrikeForceEnergy.com, promo code Cigar Nerds. And with that, we'll be right back with the main show.
Young!
Stop playing around, man. Just get up.
I'm not playing around. There's something in the water.
What do you mean there's something in
the water?
I don't
know. There's just something in the fucking water. Young! Young!
Run.
Are you all right?
And welcome back. We're stepping into the kind of the future past, because this is one of those newfangled things they'd be calling midquels instead of sequels, where it kind of happens between previously released movies.
Well, and I think I want to do it this way, because I enjoyed this so much that I don't want to spoil the shit out of it or anything right off the rip. So, you know, my thoughts are, great fucking movie. Watch it on the biggest screen possible when it comes to streaming, since you fuckers missed it in theaters. And
it's in less theaters, but it's still, you might be able to find it if you hurry.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's not going to be long.
But this is one that I definitely...
Beetlejuice is taking over screens.
recommend, you know, dark room, best sound system you got, biggest screen you got, and immerse yourself.
Yeah.
Like, this went, fuck Prometheus and all the other films. Like,
yeah, Prometheus I didn't like, and I didn't even see the one that came after that. Was it Alien Covenant? I don't think I ever got around to even seeing that one.
Yeah, like, this is what should have been. But with that said, we're going to spoil the shit out of it. So,
but yeah, just in case, spoiler alert from here on in, but before we get into like spoilers, let's talk about what this actually is. Like I said, it's on the Alien timeline. It takes place between the original movie and the second movie. So it's like, you know, like Prometheus and all that, I think, was like prequels before the main movies. And then we've had like, Alien, Aliens, Alien 3, and then that weird fourth one with Ron Perlman where she was a clone. Was that Alien Resurrection?
Yeah, I think that was Resurrection.
Yeah, and then like, so yeah, this one takes place between the first and the second movies. And but other than that, like, if you're kind of new to the Alien franchise, it's almost a standalone. Like, with the exception of some of the droid. You know,
well, there's some
there's
other
references
nods
to that, the original movie, but you could probably go into this without knowing anything.
But you
and
know,
it just being a good ass horror.
Alien
movie
is such a great movie that if you're new to this franchise and you're like, I don't understand people's obsession with the Xenomorph or whatever, like, then absolutely watch Aliens, then watch, you know, Romulus, then jump to Aliens 2, and you can kind of forget about the rest.
Yeah. But was it? Yeah, so this one starts with, like I said, kind of the only really, because we don't have Ripley. We've got a whole new cast of characters. But how they tie it into the original movie, it starts with kind of a probe going to, because if you remember the first movie, to try to kill the alien, Ripley blows up their ship and flees in an escape pod. So you see someone coming to the wreckage of that original ship from the first movie, the Nostromo, and they find basically the alien kind of cocooned in floating in space, and you know, try to study it, which of course always goes wrong when fuckers start trying to study the aliens, because you know, hey, you got acid blood, all you gotta do is, like, you know, nick yourself and I'm gonna escape out of whatever fucking hole you put me in. So yeah, that's kind of how they connect the two movies, is of course, you know, Weyland Yutani doing some shady shit. But before we get into specifics, the kind of the set decoration of this, because the original movie came out, what, 79, early 80s?
Yes.
So it was 80s version of future technology, and they kind of use that same, what people thought the future would look like back then. You know, it wasn't all clean Elon Musk fucking touchscreen shit. It was still, like, you know, fucking old ass computer monitors and keyboards and shit.
Well, the fact that you had, like, wireless instruments, you know, was a big thing. Not everything was attached to a cord.
Yeah, so, it had
or,
that,
you know, automation was a huge thing, where now, like, everything from your fucking window blinds to whatever, you know, can be automated. Back then, like, just doors being automated was big.
Yeah, it's like somebody really paid attention to make this look like it was still made in the, I mean, the effects and a lot better probably than 79, but the world looked like that original Alien movie world. I mean, it was kind of dirty, lived in, like the technology is like, all right, it's supposed to be the future, but now it kind of looks a little dated because this shit was made in the 70s. It did like an excellent job of grabbing that feel of the original movie, and then also the claustrophobia of it. Like I said, this was like playing a fucking old school survival horror game, where it's like, where some of the other movies have gotten like bigger and more, I would call, sci-fi action. This kind of went back to that original, like, trapped on a ship with something that's trying to kill me, like, horror story of the first movie.
This definitely at times felt very video game-ish to me. Not that that's necessarily a bad thing, you know, it was kind of
anybody who played that
a cross
game
between, like, Aliens and, you know, like, Alien Isolation is the game you're referring to, and
very much. I mean, some of the, like, the ship kind of looks like some of the levels on that damn game.
Or, you know, maybe not even Isolation, because Isolation, like, you truly were, you know, it's just you and the Xenomorph. There was another one, Fireteam Elite. Mm-hmm. And Fireteam Elite, like, you had the ability to squad up to four other people, and, you know, like, this did a great job of, oh, fuck, it's not a facehugger. It's, you know, like, it reminded me of the fucking Halo Flood. It's like, that's a flood of facehuggers.
Yeah, that's the one that, like, because, I mean, was it Aliens? We had a whole bunch of Xenomorphs. But this is the first time we've seen, like, a fuck ton of facehuggers. And those bastards are, like, creepy as shit when you get, like, 30 of them chasing you down a hallway.
Don't go in the water.
Yeah.
Like, word to the wise, if there's a room and there's water and you can't see below the water, should probably stay out. Especially if it's a cryogenic lab and you just like, what if we make it hot?
Yeah.
There's probably things in there that you don't want to defrost.
It's kind of like, you know, Resident Evil when they turn the power back on and that opens all the doors. So now all the zombies that have been trapped in labs are free to chase your ass through the the complex. If you're in some kind of abandoned creepy lab, never turn the power on and never turn the heat up.
but I am with you. I like how this went back to, you know, the early roots. There's certainly some nods to, you know, the other films and stuff in the franchise. And they did do some new things. And overall, like, you know, I was pretty happy with it. There was only a couple of times where there were some CGI issues that sort of, you know, just for a brief moment kind of took me away, like it was a distraction. But yeah. Then, you know, I got sucked back in and re-immersed.
And there's at least like one story part that I'm just like, you dumb bitch. Why are you doing this?
Well, I mean, there's a couple of dumb, you know, dumb things. I mean, dude.
The only part where I was just like, really? Is like, they escape, but the... All right, back it up a little bit. Our main character, Rain, has an adoptive brother who is basically a malfunction... He's an autistic android. He's a little bit malfunctiony. Her dad, like, rebuilt him out of some garbage or whatever, and her parents died in the mines, and now this is, like, her only family is this fucking droid. But he's still a fucking droid. Her and the humans escape, but the droid gets left behind, and she's like, you stay here. I'm gonna go back and save my brother. I'm like, bitch, that motherfucker's artificial. Like, get the fuck out of there. Like,
but at the same time, though, like, this does a great job of, you know, humans, the emotional connection. Like, that's the damning thing. Like, you know, all the great leaders of the world have to make the hard call. Emotion gets removed from the equation, and it just becomes, this is life or death at this point, and I don't like it, but if we're going to survive, this is a choice that has to be made.
Like, and, yeah, and like, you know, you almost just damn the whole mission by going back to get fucking R2-D2.
Well, I mean, you know, the company overall, you know, like, hey, let's go and, you know, explore and poke and prod, you know? I mean, everybody wants to be on the cutting edge of, you know, everything. So, you know, I could see from a company standpoint being like, hey, you know, you guys are elite soldiers. You got this. Go in. But, you know, I also thought that's what was great about this film is, you know, you didn't have, you know, elite military, you know.
Yeah, this wasn't
you
the
know,
Space
you're not
Marines.
Going in
a
with,
bunch of,
you know,
like kids.
You know, these are essentially people like,
well, 20-somethings, but
I'm tired of, you know, slaving away in the mine. Like, you imagine, like, hey, I've done my hours. I'm ready to, you know, not be in the mines anymore. Ah, we're short on workers. We're going to double that time.
Yeah, so basically this... Rain and her...
Is that the company calling now?
Yeah,
like,
probably.
Why are we not in our mine?
So, yeah. Yeah. So, basically, they're on a mining colony on, like, Jackson Moon. And Rain...
terrible name for a moon, by the way. Yeah. Like, I should never have a moon named after me.
That's what you say when you, like, moon people. Welcome to Jackson's Moon. But, yeah, she's basically an indentured servant, and, like, you have to do a certain amount of years in the mine. She's like, yeah, cool, like, I've finished my time. I want to transfer to a colony that has, like, sunlight at least. And they're like, nah, you're going to have to stay another 20 years or whatever. And, like, basically people are just dropping dead from, you know, basically like the space version of Black Lung. And she happens to run into some of her friends who is like, hey, we got a plan to get out of here. We have a spaceship, but it's just basically a... in-system type spaceship. It doesn't have cryogenics, so, you know, the next closest star system's like 12 years away. We won't make it without a hibernation unit, but we found this derelict spaceship in space. Inventory says it should be equipped with, you know, the stuff we need to just get the fuck out of here, but we need a android to talk to the computer so we can get into the ship. So let's use your brother to get us access so we can steal the stuff we need so we can, like, just escape this fucking port where we all die in the mines. Well, they get up there, and it turns out it's not a derelict spaceship. It's a derelict space station that was running secret alien experiments for Weyland Yutani until, you know, a xenomorph got out and basically fucking killed everybody.
And what is a xenomorph, Joe? The perfect killing machine.
Space cockroach. You can't kill those motherfuckers. And if you do, they bleed acid on you and still take you out in the end.
Or they don't, which we'll get into later.
Yeah, so they've basically, it looks like they've been cloning facehuggers, and, you know, we find out that they've basically trying to come up with a, they're like, humans are dying, we're not made for deep space exploration.
You know what they're doing, right? They're doing Jurassic Park, but instead of dinosaurs, aliens.
Yeah.
Like, I was half waiting at some point to be like, and this is DNA. The building blocks of life.
But apparently they're not just growing aliens. They're trying to make a drug that will make people kind of impervious to deep space, because the aliens, they can exist in cold and oxygen-free environments and stuff like that. And they're like, hey, look, we found this drug that makes these rats immortal. We can just squish them and they go back together. But then, like, you find out later that, oh, everyone died before we could see the end of the experiment, where eventually those rats turn into fucking monsters themselves. So your drug is not as a miracle drug as you thought it would. Needs a couple more iterations. You don't want the Gen 1 drug. You gotta wait till it makes it farther through trials.
I mean, I see so many of the, you know, different medication, and I'm sure you do too. And it's like, side effects may include blah, 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 and the side effects are worse than the ailment that they're trying to, you know.
Yeah. May cure your anxiety. Will cause diarrhea, death, butt flu.
It's like, great, I don't have anxiety just from life, but I have this, you know, anxious feeling that I'm constantly going to shit myself.
Oh.
People don't scare me. My butthole does.
Yeah, so they, yeah, and the name Romulus comes from the name of this space station, which the space station's divided into two kind of hemispheres. One is Romulus and one is Remus. Yeah, reference to an old Roman legend of the brothers Romulus and Remus. Not to be confused with Uncle Remus from that old movie that's probably banned now. So yeah, they get on the space station, they find the thing that they were going to use, but it's low on fuel. Like, oh, these containers only hold like 3 years worth of cryo, and we need to sleep for 12. So, oh, there's a cryo lab. Let's go. They probably got extra cryo fuel. We need to go get some more canisters. But unfortunately, when they get to said lab and start pulling the containers out, that defrosts all the facehuggers they've had on ice. And fuckery ensues.
Yeah.
But then we also, when they get to the homeboy, they, as they're exploring, they find one of the, what the fuck was that guy's name from the first movie that was that played the
was
droid?
Was it Rook?
Yes, Rook. So they find a damaged Rook droid. So yeah, that's the other kind of link to the original movie. And yeah, they did a good job of like the CGI, so it still looks like that guy from the 70s.
At times, like there was definitely some Skywalker effect that happened. You know, like. You know, I think it would have worked a lot better, like, because this movie had a relatively large budget, but I'm like, you know, so when he's on, like, the console and stuff, like, I think they focused on him just a little too much. Like, I'm like, ah, no, doesn't twitch.
Yeah, we've seen in the Marvel movies and Indiana Jones, the CGI de-aging is good in short doses. When you do the CGI de-aging for an entire movie, and
yeah,
after a while you start seeing the cracks in the...
it would have been good in short doses, you know, because he actually got a lot more screen time than what I would have expected. And that's where I was able to find holes. I was just like, whoa, all right, hold on. And then you know, something else would pop off and I would be back in immersive mode.
So, yeah, once they get into that lab, they accidentally set off some kind of security thing and they get locked in and they find out, like, Andy doesn't have the security clearance to get them out. So, like, hey, there's this damaged Rook unit. We'll go take his...
membrane.
Chip, and that'll probably, you know, upgrade Andy. But in doing so, they end up waking up Homeboy, and he kind of tells him, you know, yeah, we fucked up. We got this alien and started doing all these experiments, and it got out, and we managed to kill him, but his acid blood ate through the fucking system and, like, sucked all the oxygen out and killed everybody before I could seal the station back up. And, you know, also took my legs. I'm Lieutenant Dan Rook now. But yeah, when they put his chip in the malfunctioning Andy, it kind of updates his system and he turns normal for a while. But of course, he
quickly becomes a company man.
Yeah, it reboots him back to, like, you know, factory settings where now I have a cool English accent, but I'm also don't care whether you live or die, because now the prime directive is I complete the mission. Andy is now an asshole.
But, you know, to his point, like...
But he's still... So he's like, I can protect you as long as it doesn't interfere with my prime directive. So he doesn't immediately fuck them over.
Well,
but he comes close a couple times.
I don't think he... The human emotion is what fucks you over. Like, you know, you're out there
with
friends.
Yeah, he gets
very
calculating with it's like, yeah.
You know, like, if you've got less than a 2% probability of a survival situation... And if it's yourself or someone, like...
Yeah, because, like...
Like, you got to put that emotion aside and be like... You know, if we both die, it's in vain. If one of us dies, then, you know, the podcast can go on.
Yeah, because, like, they almost get back to the ship, but the alien has, you know, emerged. You know, because one of them got facehuggered and, you know... killed some people on the ship. This is, like, probably the most calculating alien we've seen so far, because he's like, you know, they're like, you got to get in there, we got to save her, and he's like no, she has, like, a very small chance of surviving, and the alien is basically using her as bait. If we open this door, he gets out and kills all of us, so yeah, she's just fucked. But so him being an asshole kind of saved their life, at least for a little while.
Like, you know, if you've got something that can be that calculated, like, wouldn't you want to know and be like, well, fuck, dude, you know, like, this is how it has to play out. But I do like how they made, you know, the alien, you know, so calculated and, you know, really setting up traps and, you know, like, it truly became like a game of chess.
Yeah, it was
like,
almost like,
oh, you guys did this. So now I'm going to pivot and do this other thing.
Very much like predator, like cat-like behavior.
Yes.
It's like, you know, it's like I'm stalking my prey and
I'm not going to pounce until the, you know, perfect opportunity.
Oh.
You know, because in the past it's like, oh, xenomorph. You know, it's just going to, like, no, like. Like, it just showed how smart and, you know, everything else, like, this, you know.
These, yeah, they're not just dumb beasts that are kind of like
just good at killing because, yeah, we're just flesh meat.
Yeah, just you know, trying to feed. They're, like, you know, stalking their prey. A lot of, like, hunter behavior in this movie. I think it really, like, fleshed out. They're not just, like, a crazy horde.
But then again, too, it's like, you know, I like the direction and how it, you know, it just
speaking doesn't... of Jurassic Park, I was waiting for that clever girl.
How it just doesn't go into kill mode, where it's like, I need your females to breed and to keep us going, so, you know, like, I'm not just instantly going to kill until, you know, they've got whatever, you know.
Yeah, I'm just
like,
gonna trap y'all so the facehuggers get it and we can make more aliens. Oh. But, and then I like, yeah, speaking of like feeling like a video game, and when eventually kind of make a deal with, they get kind of trapped and they finally make a deal with Rook where he's like, hey, if y'all complete my mission, I will, you know, pilot your ship out of here. You know, y'all are good to go. But my mission is to get this drug back to the colony for further study. Y'all complete that, I will do my best to keep y'all alive and get y'all out of here. And so they're like, he's like, yeah, do y'all know how to use weapons? And you know, one guy had been a soldier at some point before, you know, joining the mining crew or whatnot. And it's like, he's like, yeah, these are auto aim rifles. And it's like, you just kind of pull the trigger halfway and it'll lock on a target. And I'm like, oh yeah, this is like straight up from the fucking video game. like I got the aim assist on and shit. And that was kind of good. Like, all right, now we're going to get our space marine on, but we don't have to have trained space marines. That,
yeah.
These guns are set on easy mode, so we can get the shootout stuff. But he's like, also, they bleed acid, and we're awfully close to the surface of the ship, so just threaten them. They're smart enough to, like, back off, but if you shoot them, they're probably going to still fuck us, so don't do that.
Or do.
Yeah.
Which became another very video game-esque type thing. Like, there were so many, like, things that I was like, I could absolutely see, you know, this either being a quick time event or, you know, a skill check, you know,
oh, yeah.
Platformer,
especially the,
like...
Because they run into, like, they're like, all right, yeah, this way to the elevator to get us to the ship. And it's like, uh-oh. This is one of the aliens, like, breeding tunnels where he puts all the people in the cocoons for the fucking facehuggers to, or chest bursters to pop out of them. We probably shouldn't go this way, but then they're like, fuck, it's the only way out. Let's, you know, try to be sneaky, sneaky. And then...
It's all fun and games till you step on a facehugger tail.
Yeah, and then, like, you know, the whole horde of them are coming down the hall chasing them, and, like, it's just Andy and her kind of like, well, I guess we're fucked. Because we can't shoot them because the acid will... And they're like, oh, wait a minute. Let's just turn off the gravity. If there's no gravity, the acid won't, you know, fall to the ground and burn through the ship. So they, you know, go full Doom and just start, like, fucking skeet shooting facehuggers everywhere. But now there's, like, acid floating through the whole tunnel. And it's like, uh-oh, the gravity's going to auto-kick back on in, like, 10 minutes or whatnot. So we have to, like... fly through the acid tunnel and try not to touch anything. I'm like, oh yeah, this is definitely one of those like skill based moments in the game to try not to fly through a fucking cloud of acid.
It gave me flashbacks to, you remember the old school Ninja Turtle game on Nintendo?
The fucking swimming level,
yeah.
That's impossible
you
to
can't have the fucking, you know, electrified
Yeah, the like the whatever the electro tentacle things. Yeah, that was bad.
God, it was so rewarding though when you got through that shit.
Yes,
so rewarding.
And that was the days where there was no save points. So like if you ran out of lives, you went all the way back to the beginning. You're like, motherfucker. A lot of controllers got thrown in those days.
Just never let a turtle die, man.
Oh, God, that reminds me. Fucking, there's a new movie on Prime called Jackpot. I think we talked about the trailer for it. John Cena's character is obsessed with the Ninja Turtles. He sings Turtle Power in the movie. He's, like, jamming out to the old, like, T-U-R-T-L-E power. And I'm like, My God, I haven't heard that song in fucking forever. But yeah, he's like all in on like Ninja Turtles.
I'm going to have to watch that.
Yeah, it's on Prime. I watched the other night. It's actually pretty funny. It's like a comedic version of The Purge.
All right. I'm trying to remember, but...
It's basically...
Dude, we've talked about so many trailers and shit.
It's near future LA, where like it's like 2030, but they have a big lottery. But the rule is, if you win the lottery, like the lottery drawing is in the morning, you have to survive until nightfall to win the money. And if anyone kills you in that time, they get the jackpot. The only rule is you can't use guns, to make it a little more interesting. So basically, you win the lottery and the entire city of LA is hunting you and you're trying to survive until a sundown to get the money. And John Cena is like a bodyguard for a lottery winner trying to keep her alive throughout the day. And like, but it's like a comedic version of The Purge. It's pretty hilarious.
All right. Yeah, for sure. We'll check that out. I think we need to create a calendar and be like, hey, this thing's dropping on this date. Set a reminder. Because we talk about so much shit, and then I'm like, damn it. Like, I wanted to see that, and it completely fell off my radar because it wasn't mainstream enough.
Yeah, still need to see Beetlejuice. And I still got to finish watching that fucking Terminator anime. I'm only about halfway through that. See what turns out things. Like, hey, we can talk about this on the show. This was... Hey, I found a new... I write out the topics like about six months at a time, and then we may or may not use those things on the list because every once in a while something new will come out and be like, oh, this is better than the thing I'd already scheduled for this week, so let's like pivot and talk about this new thing.
Or we assume it's going to be better and we're like, oh, no, that's terrible.
Yeah, there has been a few things that we've like, yeah, we're going to do a podcast on this when it comes out, and then we watch and we're like, oh, this is fucking horrible. Yeah, it's not worth talking about. Let's find another topic this week. So yeah, we have a loose schedule, things are always getting moved around or changed as new shit gets announced, or shit we thought was going to be cool turned out to suck ass.
And not in the cool way.
Mm-mm. Not in the ass blaster way.
I keep seeing a lot more of the Tremor F-150, speaking of which.
But then we had the, they float through the acid tube and get to the elevator, but of course, I'm calling him Xenomorph Prime, shows back up and, starts attacking them in the elevator. And yeah, Andy has, she pulled the chip that was making him an asshole out, and he's back to like normal Andy mode where like my prime directive is to protect you. So he like jumps on it and like fucking dragging that damn alien down the elevator shaft, beating its head on the wall. And it's like lands. He's like, what is it? Don't touch her, you son of a bitch. Yeah. The fucking, you know, famous Ripley line from Aliens.
But you know, like this, you know, was another one of those instances where, you know, the alien actually saves her, you know, but it's like, hey, I have the ability to cocoon you and use you in ways you don't want to be used, but, you know, you're not going to die right now.
Yeah, because one of the members of the crew is actually pregnant, so the facehuggers are like, nah, this is already occupied. I'm not gonna touch this. But she does get, you know, fucked up a little bit, and when... You know, they make it to the top of the elevator because they're trying to, like, he's like, all right, she's fucked up, but if I can get her into one of the stasis chambers, I can get her first aid when we get to whatever our final destination is. So, you know, she gets her to the ship and is like, here, you take the wonder drug. I got to go back and save Andy. And, you know, and that's when the whole acid tube thing happens. But, of course, you know, she at least like gets on the ship and is like, you know, fucking Rook is like, hey, you've made it here with the drugs. Let me take over your ship and I'll fly you to safety. And she's like, fuck you, robot man. Not until my friends get here. And, you know, he keeps trying to talk her into it. And she's like, yeah, actually, like, nope, I ain't leaving unless everyone else is leaving. But she does fuck up and like I'm going to take this a dose of this wonder drug to save my life so I live long enough to save my friends. But yeah, she didn't read that side effects may include
there was laying an egg.
Yeah.
Like that's pretty intense too.
Yeah.
Like,
cuz of course it's not an alien movie unless you think you've escaped and you get that final.
Well, that was the
scare.
Thing is, you know, like that was the other thing that I really liked is, you know, the multiple endings of this movie. Because that was ending A. And then it's like, but we're not done yet.
Yeah. Rain gets back to the ship with Andy. Andy's fucked up, but she's like, all right, well, I'll put you in a... Oh, no. At first, she's like, all right, I'm going to go jump in the bed. You know, I'm going to plug you into the charging port here on the computer so you can make sure the ship makes it to wherever we're going. And, you know, I'll see you in 12 years. Peace out. And then all of a sudden, like, you know, homegirl who was pregnant and injured's alarm starts going off on her bed, and she's like, uh-oh, let me open up and check on her. And she's like going into labor, but the side effects of the drug, instead of turning her into a monster, basically turned her baby into a fucking alien human hybrid, and she basically gives birth to a fucking egg that's like the fucking looks kind of like the Peeler egg. I'm like, because someone is like, oh, I heard there's something like really fucking disturbing in that new Alien movie. I'm like, oh yeah. Even I was like, oh, that's fucking gross. It's like, I've never seen it. We've seen plenty of chest bursters, but we've never seen an alien get birthed. And that was like, oh, that's fucked up. Especially when the egg peels open and it looks kind of like a human baby.
Yeah,
until
and
it,
I
like,
think
goes into alien growth mode. And
that was more
the...
like the Prometheus style alien,
yeah.
Right? Like,
and kind of humanoid, but like weird long appendages.
It was like alienoid with a human face and a weird alien vagina thing. I don't know. Like,
yeah, it was
like Slender Man with a vagina. It was weird.
Yeah, it was way nastier than that human alien hybrid from Alien Resurrection. That one looked more alien, where this one looked more human, which made it even creepy. Yeah, like, now that you said it, yeah, fucking Slender Man. That was some like weird Slender Man alien shit.
But you know, that was one where I wish we got a little bit more background on, like, I don't know, you know, like that by far I was like, okay, the xenomorph is creepy, but this just took the creepy, weird factor to, like, 11.
Yeah, because I expected her to mutate, because when Rook is showing him the videos of them killing the rats and them coming back to life, you don't... That's kind of where the experiment ended. So, but then when they're going through the lab, you see the cages that those rats were in, like, some kind of weird monster thing had, like, burst out of them and died. So you're like, oh yeah, homegirl's gonna go full monster here in a minute. But yeah, I didn't expect her to like birth a fucking weird ass Slender Man. And I was like, oh, that's just fucking. And then it like,
I wonder if that's why like all drugs say, you know, do not use if nursing or pregnant or
yeah,
may become pregnant. Like,
oh, and then it got worse when he like started running around the ship, and it caught Mama and basically tried to breastfeed and just sucked her dry.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, that's nasty.
Yeah, like, I almost thought we were going to have, like, a Jason Voorhees, like, oh, you're my mother, like, but no, it's like, I require your life sustenance.
Oh, yeah, that was disturbing.
But I do have to say that, you know, so many films tend to get watered down and everything else. Like, I'm really glad to see the envelope truly get pushed in this film to be like, oh, there's no way they're going to go there.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, they definitely went there. Like,
yeah, this being kind of taking place in the middle of the series, I didn't expect something new. And yeah, it had that kind of alien ending where it's like you think it's done, and it's like, oh no, we got part two here, and we're doing something completely new and disgusting. And then they, I mean, it fucks up Andy. Andy tries to fight it. And she kind of pulls a, because we are on a mining ship that's carrying like a cargo container. I'm going to lure the thing into the cargo container, and then I'm just going to eject the
but
cargo.
That was container. Such another video game level where it was like, I've got to open this, but there's four levers that have to be pulled simultaneously.
Yeah, from inside the container. there's not like a remote switch to drop that shit. But yeah, I'm going to hook myself in a space
suit. This was the 70s, not the 90s, yeah. Okay?
I'm going to hook myself in a space suit with, like, you know, this cable, so when the thing detaches, it'll pull me back in. But yeah, when that thing gets, like, sucked out and is, like, just fucking full-on Indiana Jones and the, you know, arc open face-melting shit going on. It was like, oh, yeah, probably already going to have nightmares, but I'm definitely having nightmares now. Because, of course, it always gets one last scare, like, I'm going to jump on you, even though my face is melting, and then eventually I'll fall the fuck off. And that was a cool effect, too, when they're like, all right, not only was it claustrophobic, it put a time stand like, oh, we've only got like an hour to complete this mission because the space station's orbit is degrading and it's going to crash into the rings of this planet we're on, which is basically just a big asteroid field. So yeah, when that really looked a cool effect when the space station started hitting the, just grinding itself to bits on the fucking rings of that planet.
Yeah, and I did like that about this film too, like where, like, I think it would be cool to be able to see more of the overall universe, you know? Like, you know, instead of just being like, all right, we're on this ship, like, you know, I thought it was an awesome thing just to add a scale to everything. And then be like, okay, we're going to dial it in, and, you know, for you folks that suffer from claustrophobia, here you go. Hold on to your butts. That was a Jurassic Park reference.
I mean, and they had to reset computers like Jurassic Park. Oh.
So, I think it's just funny. But, I don't know. I was just overall blown away with the pushing of the envelopes, you know? Like, I've been disappointed with the Alien franchise for a while, you know? And this is just, you know, such a fresh breath of, you know, renewal for me as far as, like, why can't we keep doing this? Like, this is what Aliens should be.
Yeah, it's back to that kind of horror legacy, because like I said, first movie very much horror, and then it kind of got less claustrophobic, more like a sci-fi action, especially Resurrection. But yeah, that dark, the xenomorphs always look better in like low lighting. They're just way creepier than them like running around in the fucking daylight and shit. You can hide a lot of bad CGI in darkness.
But, I mean, my issues with the CGI really weren't, you know, with the xenomorph or anything. It was all Rook. Poor Rook.
I mean, he was mainly they say practical character enhanced by CGI and deepfake technology, but yeah.
But, I mean, I think, you know, by and large, like, what made this movie feel so good was the lack of CGI. Because a lot of what we got to see was all practical.
Yeah, but unfortunately, like, Ian Holm, who played the original...
Yeah, I mean, I understand why they did it.
He is passed, so, yeah, they had to, yeah, basically... It wasn't just, like, the Marvel CGI de-aging. They basically had to, like, create him from scratch and use filtering software called Speecher that you basically used his dialogue from the original film to make his dialogue. Yeah, you know, so you know, everything was basically CGI. You know, over a practical person, character, whatever. But yeah, it just technology's close, but it's just not quite there. It's good in short doses.
But then again,
he got like too much screen time.
Here's the scary part: do we want it to be there? Like, what's happening with AI and ChatGPT, some of the other platforms where it's like, oh, I'm going to record a snippet of your voice, and hey, I need a voice confirmation to authorize blah, blah, blah. Well, anybody with a voice recording out there, here you go.
Are in the time of dirty politics. How easy is it going to be to like do like fake, you know, ads and shit and make candidates say, yeah, you know, whatever fucked up shit that you want them to say, and then you know, how do you prove that it's CGI? So it's like cinematically, yeah, I'd like it to be there for the rest of the life. No, okay, I'm good with bad cinematic CGI because I don't want to have to like,
yeah, like you know, at what point is
question
like,
everything I see?
I mean, I already do, but you know, but then again,
what's
yeah,
that old
I mean,
saying, believe nothing you hear and only half of what you see.
Exactly, like.
I think that ratio is getting like, yeah, believe nothing you hear and like three quarters of what you see.
Maybe. Maybe. But, you know, like, you know, I mean, I guess this is the reason you started doing video, just so you can, you know, be like, yeah, this is actually us doing a thing.
Yeah, whoever dies first, we're gonna need your voice right so that I can create the AI.
I mean, dude, you know, it's gonna be me for sure.
You're gonna fall off a tower, but get an AI, Brad.
But God damn it, this thing is on. You know,
especially we've done this is 239 episodes, not counting like the random YouTube shit. Like, there's enough audio and video of us that yeah, we could probably. Recreate quite easy to be fucking doppelgangered at this point.
You're gonna be like, okay, I've got 200 and you know a quarter mil invested in artificially something that, god damn it, still isn't making me money.
Yeah,
well, AI like, Brad is just unreliable as you know, in person Brad.
But I mean, James Earl Jones signed over his voice rights to Disney before he passed, so like.
They can continue.
They can keep doing Darth Vader's and you know, CGI some James Earl Jones voices and whatever they want to do. I think Tom Cruise has done the same. Like, so yeah, once he, you know, he's gonna be like, fucking, Mission Impossible 38 with CGI fucking Tom Cruise.
At what point does the mission become possible?
Okay, y'all should really rename this because y'all keep saying these missions are impossible, but you keep fucking pulling them off. I think you don't. That word doesn't mean what you think it means. We're gonna have to start calling it Mission Improbable.
I don't know. But to get back on Aliens, like this being 20th Century Fox, I really thought it was gonna be a lot more watered down than it ended up being, and I think we can sort of thank Deadpool for that. Like, I think they've seen where. You can have a hard R and, you know, do disgusting things.
Yeah.
It's... And still, like, you know, push those envelopes.
As far as, like, action and horror goes, I think we're back there. I think we're still, for some reason, comedy. I have not really.
Comedy is
all
a whole different animal, you know.
But as far as horror and action stuff. Yeah, they're going back to the hard R, but I miss the good hard R comedies too. Which,
well, I mean,
we're getting close. I mean, hell, Deadpool, like that's a great example of a fucking R rated comedy at this point. But yeah, it's like I think we're getting there. It's like the pendulum is always swinging back and forth, and I think we're starting to swing back in the more normal.
I don't think so.
Way.
No, the you know, I think back to. And I'm sure there is still great, you know, stand-up comedy and stuff happening.
Yeah, stand-up comedy, I think, is back. But as far as cinematic comedy,
yeah,
it's, they're still playing it a little safe.
You but, know. But then
I'm,
again,
I'm hopeful,
you know,
like, yeah,
it's all subjective. But I feel like, you know, if somebody is doing a bit and you can't remove, like, I don't know, you know, I love Metalocalypse. Anybody that's, you know, ever seen the show or know me knows why. But, you know, I love, you know, they're talking about how to be good comedians and stuff. And it's like, well, to be a comedian, you must first, you know, hate yourself. And then second, hate your audience. But I always love that bit.
Oh. We go to food libraries, talkies.
I got to do that later.
Oh. But yeah.
But overall, like, great fucking film. Great, you know.
Yeah, with Fox getting acquired by Disney, it's like,
you know,
are
and
we gonna,
well,
we gonna
and I, that was my concern
and,
was, you know,
but nah, they were like, no, nah, we're. But does that make Ripley a Disney princess now?
Dude, Ripley's always been a Disney princess. But you know, that was the reason I brought up the Deadpool thing is, you know, I think if Deadpool, you know, because that's Disney doesn't really, you know, up until that point, wasn't really pushing those envelopes. Of,
yeah, they're like, yeah, we are at our heart a children's company. But then, like, Deadpool came out and, like, one of the first, like, what are highest grossing R-rated comic book movie. And then, you know, once they got acquired by Disney, they're like, oh, my God, they're going to fuck this up. And Disney's like, nah, we like family-friendly stuff, but we also like money. And this shit made a fuck ton of money. So like, they're like, y'all do whatever you want, just could you cut back on the cocaine? That's where we're going to draw the line. Like, sweet. We're just going to make fun of you for not letting us talk about cocaine.
But, I don't know. Obviously, you know, theatrically, this film, you know, made shitloads of money. I don't really know where it stacks with everywhere else.
Yeah, like, budget for this movie was $80 million. So far, it's made $332 million. So, I would say that's fairly successful for an Aliens movie. But we didn't even talk about the other cast. We talked about Rain and Andy. We also have... played by Kaylee Spaney and David Johnson, but we also have Tyler, which is Rain's ex-boyfriend, Archie Renault, and Kay, which was the lady who gave birth to the alien, played by Isabelle Mercade, and Bjorn, Tyler's brother, who's kind of a dick, and you're like, all right, yeah, that guy finally fucking died. Like, with the exception of Rain and Kay, like, the rest of the group, you're like, and then Navarro,
well,
the
I
pilot,
mean,
who was the, and, she was the first one to get
and that's
face-hugged.
Kind of the downfall,
oh,
right? Like,
that scene when they get her back to the ship, because she's the first one to get face-hugged, and they don't know what's going on yet, and she's like, oh, I'm having pains, let me grab this x-ray machine, and, like, puts it, like, behind her back, and you can see the fucking chest burster, like, roaming around in her chest cavity before it actually, like, bursts out. Yeah, that, like, fucking x-ray of her before she, like, explodes was like, I was like, oh, that's a cool new effect. I haven't seen that. That looks badass.
Well, I also like how they did the, you know, the bursting effect on this, because it was truly, like, no, we're gonna rip, we're gonna tear. It
oh, yeah,
wasn't
it's
just
gonna
a...
be disgusting.
Yeah,
everyone around is going to get, like, some splatter.
You know, that...
So, since this has made a bunch of money, you think we're going to get a continuation of this? Because at the end of it, she's in the cocoon, or in the cryo thing, she's thrown what's left of Andy in the cryo thing, and like, well, don't know if the ship's going to get there or not, but we're on our way to a... Which, this was a good kind of self-contained story, but do we start getting more kind of little one-off self-contained stories in the Alien universe? Because I definitely think this has the potential to revive the
franchise.
Yeah,
I mean, there were definitely times where there were things that felt rushed. Like, we got a whole new xenomorph, you know, for all intent and purposes, and only got 20 minutes with it. Like, I don't know, you know,
it was kind of a slow burn at times, but that really added to that creepy claustrophobic feel. The one where they're like, hey, we've got to make it through this hallway full of fucking facehuggers, and you can't make a sound because they're basically blind.
Well, and I do like the fact, too, like, you know, speaking of that, like, where they are like, oh, maybe they sense the body temperature.
Oh, there's a stealth mission in this game. Yeah. Fuck.
You know, so they turn up the heat, you know, to match, you know, the body temperature. But it's like, you know, you've got to keep your anxiety and your fear level low. That way you don't sweat. Like, you know, I thought that was, you know, pretty fucking brilliant.
And then homegirl starts calling them on the radio, and they're like, oh, fuck, we should have muted our phones. And it's like, and then Andy's just like, yeah, run.
Oh, what is that from? Like, oh, God, there was a game, or I know it's an Ice Nine Kills.
I think it's from the Resident Evil song.
Yeah. And it's just like, run. I'm like.
Well, that's pretty much all we got for you on this. Any final thoughts on this here movie before we give you our final cigar thoughts?
Yeah. I mean, if you made it this late into the show without seeing Romulus, still see Romulus. Like,
turn the lights off since you're going to have to be doing it at home now. Lock your cat up, because if the cat jumps on you in the middle of watching this, you're going to think it's a facehugger and chunk that little furry bastard across the room.
It's got me. But yeah, this returning to the roots, you know, the pacing, like you said, at times had a little bit of an issue. Like, on a scale of, you know, 1 to 10, I'm at a solid, you know, 8.5. Probably even a 9.
Yeah, because it... I mean, if you go back to the original had some, like, a lot of build-up in places, because we were dealing with just one alien. And like I said, other than, like, the main cast, and even the main cast did some dumb shit, but, like, the supporting victims, a lot of them are like, all right, yeah, I'm glad that guy's a dad. He was an asshole. But yeah, this one was surprisingly good. And the cigar also surprisingly good. It's got kind of a medium. I wouldn't call it like full, but it's got a lot of flavor, kind of a little bit of cocoa, hazelnut, some kind of like dark, like raisiny sweetness, but not like super sweetness. This would probably go good with some coffee, maybe a stout, some aged rum, if you want to go full pirate. And then, of course, it's called Thunder Smoke. How can you not, like, smoke something called Thunder Smoke? Because it just sounds badass.
Thunder Smoked.
And it makes you miss the rains down in Africa. What do you think of your brick house there?
Dude, just a fucking timeless classic, you know. Pairs great with the fucking, you know, mocha and the coffee, because you get, you know, a little bit of spice, some earthiness, of a hint of a chocolate type flavor. Like, dude, I'm always a fan of Nicaraguan cigars. And
both of these are flavorful enough, but they're in that medium range where it's going to be a day like I had yesterday where I'm smoking multiple cigars in a day. This one's not going to kill me. I could fire up another cigar after this.
You know,
so it's a good like early day cigar.
You know, you and I both are powerhouse smokers. Like somebody, you know, I could see them being like, ah, this is a little bit more on the fuller side of things. But for me,
Yeah, this, like, this is a nice coffee morning cigar.
Yeah.
You know, if I started off with a fucking Diablo, I'm going to be like, yeah, I'm burned out. I'm going to have to, like, rest a little bit before I smoke something else. But this one, I'm like, yeah, I can have my coffee, have a cigar, and then continue on with my day. But that's all we got for you. We'll be right back with our Dragon Con interviews. And don't forget to like, comment, and subscribe if you're watching us on YouTube. Peace out.
Into the captivating world of Hollywood storytelling with Tales from Hollywoodland. Join producers Arthur E. Friedman, Stephen J. Rubin, and Julian Schlossberg as they uncover the secrets behind your favorite entertainment. From juicy behind-the-scenes tales to classic Hollywood dirt, we've got it all. Tune in each week for compelling stories, industry insight, and behind-the-scenes tidbit. Don't miss out. Join us for Tales from Hollywoodland, available on all major platforms. Your Hollywood adventure starts here.
And welcome back, Stephen Grenade. You were probably one of our first Dragon Con guests long, long ago.
It has been a hot minute.
We figured it's been enough years, there have been enough new things out, and you've done a few new things, so I figured it was a good time to check back in with you. First off, we saw you got a new game
I did brought out. Yes, so my pandemic hobby ended up writing a new game for Choice of Games. That came out. It was supposed to be like 150,000 word choice-based game. So it's like the old Choose Your Own Adventure books, right? So you go through there and you make choices and you've got statistics behind you, sort of like the D&D kind of stats.
Yes.
Except it's a game in which you are the professor at a secret magical school at a university. So you're having to teach all the young whippersnappers who are doing dangerous things.
You're not the Harry Potter. You're the
yeah, exactly
the Professor Snape in this
exactly.
world.
Yes, which you can choose to be if you wish. And it was supposed to be 150,000 words, and 500,000 words later, and I was like, here it is. I'm so tired. I wrote so much.
Other game designers have. What kind of comes first? You is it. The mechanics of the game, or is it the story? And then you find the mechanics to fit the story.
They kind of come together. So that was a game where the company has a very strict house style. You know that it's going to be choosing options from a menu. You know that you're going to have stats underlying it. So given that and the fact that people like to see numbers go up in those kinds of games, what is a story that supports that? And what kind of story can you tell where you're making choices that feel meaningful to you, the player, and that you understand, oh, these numbers went up and I understand why. So I really sort of have to, if I'm given the mechanics first, then it's a story that fits it. If the story comes to me first, then often it's like, okay, what is the right form for this to take? Sometimes that is a choice-based game. Sometimes that is, you know, actual more traditional video game mechanics, you know, you run and shoot and things like that. So a lot of it has to work together in my mind, or nobody wants a game that really was supposed to be a novel.
Exactly.
With that, when you have like, all right, I have a choice based game where it's like choose your own adventure.
Mm-hmm.
How do you decide? Like, all right, we're starting here and we need to end here. How do you like? kind of influence the player's choices to get to the end point that you, as the designer, was like, all right, this is the end spots that I'm wanting to guide them to.
Yeah. There are a couple of different ways you can do that depending on how big the thing is going to be. Because the temptation is always like, well, every time the player makes a choice, it's going to be two different stories. And so then when they make the next choice, now you have four different stories, and then you have eight. And like it just keeps going up and up and up. So the technique for the one that I just did, Professor of Magical Studies, like the fancy term is branch and bottleneck. Mm-hmm. So there were 11 chapters, and each chapter sort of comes to a singular point before going on to the next one. And you sort of build up information about the choices that the player has made in part through those stats, because you know, like, did they prioritize being clever over being strong? Did they prioritize being diplomatic over being forthright? And so you sort of capture some of those choices through those numbers and other tracking variables and things like that. And so then as you get towards the end, you start to spread out more until the final chapter. That's when the payoff happens, and if they've been secretly evil all along, then they can steer hard into that and, you know, destroy the world and hope they end up on top. If they've been trying to be good, then they can, like, maybe I can save the world. So it's really sort of making sure that the player understands and can see that their choices are having impacts, but then constrain the story as much as possible through those bottleneck points.
So you don't have to end up with 50 endings.
Yes. Yeah. Well, it's like the...
It's like spread and then narrow back. Bring the ship back for a landing.
Right. Well, it's like the video game, The Ghosts of Tsushima. It all builds to this choice that you make, and it is a binary choice at the very end of the game, right? So that then they can be like, you made your choice, and we don't have to do anything more.
Well, last time you were here, we talked about sci-fi, or real science in sci-fi. A lot of things come out since then. We'll start with what's kind of the best real fictional thing that they've gotten the science right. What's some new things that you've seen that are like, all right, that's at least plausible, if not 100% true?
Yeah. So on the book side, the author Mary Robinette Kowal has an alternate history series where an asteroid crashes into the Earth in like the 1950s. Mm-hmm. So you get global cooling from all the stuff that gets thrown up into the atmosphere, but then the greenhouse effect really starts to run away, and it's going to get so hot, so they've got to get to space, and they've got to get humans living on the moon, on the Mars, as far as possible, as quickly as possible, because the Earth is going to get uninhabitable. And she worked with scientists and astronauts and all those kinds of things to try to have a story that was very grounded in what might really be possible. TV-wise, I just finished The Three-Body Problem, which is a lot of fun. It leans heavily on science and science ideas, but it doesn't let that get in the way of the story mm-hmm. that it's wanting to tell. So that's, as I have been doing this for a while and looking at, like, science and entertainment, really where I've gotten to is, like, the science needs to serve the story. Like, the story comes first. It needs to be...
Yeah, sometimes you got to invent stuff to fit that narrative.
Yeah, or if, like... If you have to get the science wrong for the story, get the science wrong. What frustrates me is when people don't have to get the science wrong for the story, but they do anyway.
They're just
anyway.
Lazy, like, storytelling.
Well,
point, yeah.
I mean, it's not their area.
Yeah.
So true. I understand why it happens, and I'm sympathetic, but I'm like, oh, I wish you could have taken, like, a couple of steps more and gotten to something that is more grounded in reality.
Because yeah, I know for me, I'm law enforcement background, martial arts background, so bad martial arts and bad
right.
police techniques, those two that will take me out of a story.
Oh man,
I don't mind if it's like, all right, I understand, like, you wouldn't do this in real life, but it fits the story. But when it's just, why are you doing this at all? Just like bad mechanic. Like, no, this, I'm out the story at that point.
When I was in graduate school, our upstairs neighbor was in med school, so we watched all the med dramas. You know, yeah. all the what is it?
House and
all of those kinds of things, and she would get just irate.
That
was my that was more entertaining than the show, was watching her blood pressure rise and finally be like, that's not how you do CPR. Like,
yeah, my mother's a nurse. I can't watch cops, so she can't watch medical shows. It's like those two are so what's something that's you've like, oh, this is just dumb. Like, what's the bad? It might have been a good story, but you're like, the science in this is just stupid.
So my favorite one of those, because it is just dialed to 11, is Moonfall. I don't know if y'all have seen that.
I saw the trailer. I haven't actually. I'm behind on watching some things. I know what you're talking about, but I haven't like delved into it yet.
Yes, that's the one where like the moon is coming closer to the Earth, and so gravity, weird gravity things are happening, and so they've got to get a shuttle mission that they fly up, and there's like gravity is getting so wacky that water is getting pulled up, so they fly the shuttle through the water spout. And then it turns out aliens are behind all of this and have a megastructure inside the moon. It is bonkers in the best kind of way. Like, it's at that point, everything is dialed to 11 and nothing is actually believable. And I find that really entertaining.
It's like Armageddon. It's yes. Like, it's like there's same no way director. We're doing this. It, okay. There's like, it, like yeah, if it's something that's like kind of in my wheelhouse, if it's so ridiculous, then I'm like, all right, this is just fun. I don't have to like critique it.
Well, that was like one of the space movies I really enjoyed from the last couple of years is Space Sweepers, which is a South Korean film about people tending junk in space. And like the
definitely
start,
a future job at this point. Yeah. There's a lot of garbage up there.
But the way that they deal with it is that you've got these people who have rockets that are zipping around in orbit, and they use harpoons to like harpoon it in. But of course, there's valuable stuff in the junk. So multiple people are trying to harpoon it, and there's like this big race through all the junk with people harpooning stuff and trying to drag it apart. And again, it's just bonkers, but it is so much fun.
I've noticed all your Dragon content. We got some AI is becoming so much bigger since the last time we. I mean, AI has always been kind of that realm of sci-fi. Now it's like, oh no, this is sci. No, there's no more fi.
Yeah.
Like, in your opinion, like, what's kind of the good of it, and what's like the scary of it? What should we be worried about? As we always make the joke on here every time we talk about a robot thing. It's like, if you don't want Skynet, quit trying to build Skynet. Right.
Do you want Skynets? This is how you get Skynets. So I've been working in that area for 15 plus years, except we mainly talked about it as being machine learning. Mm. The idea that you could create an algorithm that you could train to find patterns. That was the whole purpose of it. And my background was in image processing. And you used to do that through all these different techniques of like, we started out saying, well, maybe we can have conceptual features that you look at. Like, I want to see if this is a cat. I'll look for paws and a tail and ears and things like that. And then they moved to like mathematical descriptors that essentially captured, are there curves or angles or corners or lines? Because those are things that you can use to identify it. And then eventually, like in the 2010s, they realized if you train one of these neural networks and dump enough data into it so that it can learn the patterns. You don't know what patterns it's learning. Like, that's a little opaque, but it can start to recognize and classify dogs versus cats. It can start to identify people, which is kind of the scary part. So I think there's a lot of value in those kinds of things. There are typically what I've seen is that we call it AI until it starts to work, and then we don't call it AI anymore. You know, the big thing right now is this whole generative AI, your ChatGPT and the like.
The weird, like, new art stuff now where it's like
and
creating.
The diffusion models like Midjourney where you just go in and say, you know, do this picture and it like spits it out. But we're not seeing it. We are seeing it juxtapose words, images, things like that, that it has seen. It's not creating new stuff. And that's the weakness of all of these kinds of algorithms, is that they mainly understand the things that they have seen before and can then either classify or predict or, in this case, make new stuff.
Fake creativity. It's not really creating anything new. It's taking other stuff and kind of remixing it.
Yeah, well, and I think – so it has some of the aspects of creativity, and that I think, you know, all artists, all writers – there is some mix mastering going in of things that you have read before, seen before, things like that. But the stuff that's the most interesting to me has always got the human touch of like, this is informed by my experiences, what I have lived through, what I have seen, my point of view. And for the similarities among us, there's also so many individual things. And that's where it gets really interesting to me as a book, as a movie, as a video game, you know, is what is sort of new about it. And that's not something that we can do with our current, what we're calling AI. It makes statistically likely art. And I'm looking for the statistically unlikely in my art.
Yeah, it's only as good as the kind of data set it's trained on.
Right.
Yeah, it's like, Where is that? I've seen so many random stories, especially like these Chat GPT style stuff that's like just turning racist or yelling right at people. It's like, you spend too much time on Reddit. It's like it's
right, exactly.
These things aren't turning evil on their own. It's the data set you're using to train. It's like, oh, yeah.
Well, that was like when they realized that, I think it was ChatGPT, one of the models, you could convince it to write Omegaverse fanfic, which if you're not familiar with Omegaverse, look it up. You'll enjoy it, please. And it's like, oh, because it was trained on publicly available stories on AO3. And so it learned, quote unquote, those concepts from it.
Yeah, it's kind of, I guess, like I said, if you say, all right, read all of this author's works or all this author's stuff, it can kind of at least give you a reasonable recreation of that. You know, if you give it, like, I mean, there's several books I've read where, like, all right, I know this artist has a formula. You can see right the formula that they write to, and it's like, I guess the AI can probably pick up more formulaic stuff easier
because
than.
Because it sees those kinds of patterns. The real thing that they struggle with, there's what is called the context window. That is, how much information do you feed in before it starts generating the next stuff? And so, like, if you go back to ChatGPT 3 and 3.5, if you asked to tell it, tell me a story, after, you know, however many paragraphs, you would realize that it had invented new things, it had wandered off the story, didn't cohere from beginning to end. They're increasing those context windows so that it can know more about the past and have a better idea of what came before it. But there's still that limitation there. It can never realize, oh, yeah, in chapter one, this person's eyes were green.
Continuity errors, just like everyone else. Just got to give it an editor.
Yep.
For someone like outside the industry, it at least appears from the outside that there's been just a huge leap forward in AI. Has it just gotten more popular in the last couple? Has this been a slow growth and then we're just now seeing the results of everything, or is it really kind of advancing as quickly as it appears
it
to
is
be?
It has been advancing really quickly. Like the to go back to my image processing stuff, the first time we saw one of these deep neural nets do really well on can you classify these images competitions was like 2011. It jumped way ahead of all the other approaches and has just kept getting better. I think like with the generative stuff, the transformer model that ChatGPT and these others use, that's the algorithm under the hood, Google invented it in like 2017. And it really started ramping up after that. So that's the first thing, is that we really are making advances in these models and the ways of doing this. The second thing is that the scale and accessibility has increased tremendously. Because it used to be, if you were going to tinker around with one of these things, you had to fire up a Python language interpreter and you had to build this source and download these libraries. And now, well, if you want to do that, even you can go to this website and say, give me this latest model. And it sort of like sucks it in and is ready to go. So a lot of those are accessible. And then tools like ChatGPT, like Anthropic's Claude and all of those, there's an API. You can just go to the website and type stuff in. It's so much readily available that I think that has made people suddenly say, oh my gosh, this is surprising and surprisingly easy. And I don't discount the fact that there are a lot of people with a bunch of money squirreled away from their days at the internet saying, we want this to happen real bad. Here's buckets of money that we'll keep throwing into the fire until we make Fetch happen. We're just going to keep trying.
Yeah, it's like the young nerds that grew up on like Terminator and all that.
Yeah, exactly.
Like we can now fund these sci-fi things that we right dreamed up back in the day.
Yep.
What about is there anyone working on kind of the, I guess, safeguards? Because it's like, you know, with the deep fake and all that, like, right, you know, there's a lot of people now that are like, I can't believe the things I see on TV because it could be a deep fake, some kind of AI generated false story that, you know, Tom Cruise is now telling us the aliens are invading or whatever.
Yeah.
Do you know anything about like the security side of it? Are there people working kind of to try to put brakes on all this?
Yeah. So there's a couple of aspects of that. The first is that people are working on, for example, ways to bake a set of ethics into these models as you're training them to try to make them less likely to, for example, spew racist BS.
Yeah.
So there are definitely people working on it from that end. The thing that gives me hope is that we have been through these kinds of technological changes before where we started to say, oh my gosh, I can't believe anything. You know, we've been through that with photography a couple of times. because at first it was like, oh, a photo is absolutely something that you can believe. And then people started making fakes. You had the Cotswold fairies photo. You've got Nessie, right? That famous, the surgeon's photo of the Loch Ness Monster on the guy's deathbed. He admitted, yeah, I faked that.
And even before AI, we had Photoshop.
And then, yes. So that's like the first set, and then Photoshop and the fact that, oh, things could be Photoshopped all that you wanted. And we've had to learn to be more discerning about what we believe when we see a photo, that we understand that it has potentially been touched up. You know, it is a little concerning that it's so much easier now that, for example, you know, Google's latest phone will happily edit people out of pictures or...
Yeah, you used to have some kind of skill set to manipulate things. So now it's app-based half the time.
Well, and because it is so easy, that opens it up to a lot more people to experiment, which is both cool and also troublesome. So was a limited amount before, because you had to have the tools and you had to have the skill set and you had to, like, participate in, I don't know, Something Awful's Photoshop Friday. Now you just say, hey, phone, do this, and it does it. So we're going to be contending with that for a while.
And kind of as we bring this in for a landing, because you've been in the middle of this for years and years now, Dragon Con, the people that don't understand how much real science you can come and, like, see, we've talked to NASA people, talked to, you know, all, like, just take a minute to tell the audience that haven't come to Dragon Con that just thinks it's, you know, Marvel, DC, nerd stuff, that, like, you can come here and actually learn from physicists, astronauts, you know, whatever. So there's definitely heavy sci in the sci-fi convention.
That's one of the things that I love about this convention is absolutely come if you, you know, you want to see Marvel stuff and geek out with folks. If you're fans of, like, a 1970s sci-fi show, we've got a fandom for that and we've got a track that's covering that. But we've also got tracks like mine, the science track, the space track, the, you know, robotics and makers track, where we bring in people, like we have official NASA people here this year. We have an astronaut who's speaking, who can talk about science and space, and who are also nerds and really like conventions and are coming at us like, we also love these things that you love. Let's talk about them together. That we can do serious talks, like I've got one on the track this year where we're going to talk about the challenges of measuring big things and small things. Like, how do you measure something big like a galaxy or a gravity wave? How do you measure something small like an atom or a 1/1,000,000th of a second long event? And that's very science heavy. But then we're also going to have tonight at 10 p.m., which is in the past when you're hearing this, but just time travel.
Be ready for next year. There'll be something similar.
There will be something similar. And this year it is The Mating Habits of Kaiju. So we're going to take an incredibly silly thing, but say, all right, let's talk about the scientific aspects of if you had these giant monsters. We're just going to push the square cube law aside and say that doesn't matter. These monsters exist. How do they reproduce? What are their life cycles like? What would their mating habits be?
Well, finally, how can people find you, follow what you're doing, pick up some games? Plug all your socials
and
whatnot.
I have pluggables. I'm most active these days on Blue Sky. It is at Grenades, GRANADES.com is my handle. On Twitter, X. I am still
the same.
I'm still haunting there as at Sargent, S-A-R-G-E-N-T. Either of those will link to my website, which has all of my information. You can get linked to the game. You can get linked to the stuff I'm doing at Dragon Con, all those kinds of things.
All right. Well, thanks for being here. Talk to you again in another couple
Dragon Cons. Yes, thank you so much for having me back.
No problem.
And now it's time for Blowing Smoke.
And welcome back. We are sitting down with Alanka Dunin, if I hopefully pronounce that right. With some of our other shows here.
Daddy Mojo, hello.
Daddy Mojo.
You want to kick it off, sir?
Yeah, sure thing. Ms. Alanka, just a question, because what you do is so utterly confusing to me. How would you best describe to the layperson what you do?
I am an amateur historian of classical ciphers.
And a cipher, because we've all seen National Treasure, is basically a riddle, a physical riddle of sorts.
Well, it depends how technical you want to be. There are ciphers, there are cryptograms, there are codes, Technically, a cipher is a system that is used to encrypt something. Usually, like if you were to take the Caesar cipher, you would take all the letters in the alphabet and shift them by three. So an A becomes a C, a B becomes a D, a C becomes an E, and so forth. So that's a system where you can take any text that you want to encrypt, and you can use that cipher system, which is different from a code, where you generally need a code book. And so if you wanted to encrypt the word cat, you would need to look up the word cat. I'm waving my hands in the air here. You would need to look up the word cat and see, aha, the word for cat is turtle. And so anything you wanted to encrypt would have to be in the book in order for you to encrypt it.
Well, I guess kind of to back up a little bit anyone who are not familiar with what we're talking about, what is kind of, I guess, the short synopsis of what, you know, cryptology, you know, actually is? Like, when we say that, you know, what are we talking about?
So it comes from the Greek. So cryptos means hidden, and logos means book or study, so the study of things that are hidden. So cryptography, crypto, hidden, and grapheme, like pencil, graphite, means to write. So cryptography means to create a code. Cryptanalyst is someone who studies codes. So technically, I am a cryptologist, but, you know, even with people who are in the field, we're just all cryptographers.
That's a good umbrella for the yeah. creators, the breakers, and the historians
yeah.
of it all.
Yeah.
Well, for the code breaking side, I mean, is there, when you first look at a unknown code, is there like, let me check the first couple things. Where do you start when you start trying to decode something that's like an unknown?
Sure. Well, I take a step back and I just look at the whole thing. And I think about who wrote this, why did they write it? Was it written with the intention that it be broken by somebody? Or was somebody just goofing around and just putting down random letters, which happens sometimes? And then in proper usage, a code or a cryptogram or a cipher or anything is written with the intent that it's going to be broken. It's usually something that's used in wartime. So you have a sender who is writing something like, hey, we need to bring in the bomber planes. They need to bomb here right now, right? And it's encrypted and it's sent to bomber command, where they decrypt it and go, aha, we need to send the bombers there right now. And so it needs to be something that can be done fairly quickly in wartime conditions. You know, bombs are going off.
You want the intended recipient to be able to decode it, and everyone along the way to be like, I don't know what this is.
yeah, exactly.
So since we're not in an active state of wartime, what do you mainly decode now or create codes for?
Well, the primary reason today is recreation. So you go to the store and you buy a book on crossword puzzles, and in the back there will be some codes, cryptograms that people are decrypting for fun. Yeah. There are also some famous codes that have never been cracked. So there are, and that's something that's one of my areas of expertise, is famous unsolved codes.
Like that thing you heard.
Yes, when I was reading about you earlier, about cryptos.
Oh,
what,
yeah.
What exactly is that?
Oh,
I've never heard of this before this morning.
Ah, I can tell you all about cryptos.
Its location is why you haven't heard of it much.
It's a sculpture at CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia. It's about 12 feet tall, 20 feet long. It's a big, tall, petrified tree trunk with these sheets of copper that are scrolling out of it, like paper scrolling out of a printer. And there are about 1,700 characters that are carved through it, so you can look through the letters and see the other side of it. And it's a challenge that was created by an artist named Jim Sanborn, and it was a challenge for the employees at the CIA. Right now, we know, so it's been there since about 1990, and we know now that there are four codes on it. Three of the four have been solved. The fourth has not been solved yet, and it's one of the most famous unsolved codes in the world.
So yeah, obviously being a sculpture at the CIA, it's not like anybody can walk up to it. How did you get into studying cryptos?
I had heard, and this is how I got into the public cryptography scene. It was through DragonCon, actually. DragonCon got me into this. So these are, you guys are my peeps here, you know, DragonCon. So I was attending some of the sessions actually at the EFF track, the Electronic Frontiers track. And these were sessions on hacking. And these were the white hat hackers who were coming in and teaching people how to secure their computers so that the bad guys couldn't get in. And at the time, they were handing out flyers with all the other stuff you get at a convention. And one of the flyers was about a convention called Freaknik, spelled P-H-R-E-A-K, Freaknik, a hacker convention in Nashville, Tennessee. And this flyer was a code. It was on a sheet of paper, and it had just a bunch of letters at the top of the paper saying, if you can crack this code, you'll win a free trip to a HackerCon. And the intent had been, when it was created, that it was supposed to be just entertainment for the attendees at Freaknik 3, which had been a year earlier, but no one had cracked it yet. So now they were handing the code out at DragonCon saying, hey, can anyone crack it now? So I picked the flyer up with all the other flyers, you know. Now it's stickers, but at the time then it was flyers. I picked it up with all the other stuff you get at a convention, and then I brought it home with me. I was living in St. Louis at the time, and then there was a weekend later that I was just, I think I was home with the flu or something, and I was really bored. I'm like, okay, I'm going to take a look at the Freaknik 3 code, and I got obsessed with it. I got into the zone. And like my friends would say, hey, do you want to go to a movie? I'm like, don't talk to me unless you want to talk about the code. And it took me 10 days, but I cracked it. And I won a free trip to a HackerCon and free drinks and T-shirts and all that. So not that it's hard to get free drinks at a HackerCon. But so I got to go to Freaknik 4. And in the Freaknik 3 code, it was created sort of like the layers of an onion. So you had to solve one layer and then solve another layer and solve another layer. And there were also dead ends and red herrings. And one of them was, okay, you've gotten this far, now go solve this. And it gave you a URL, which was to the CIA website. And it was, at that time, the CIA website where they had a picture of the sculpture Cryptos. It was like, go solve this now. And so I read about it, and I'm like, oh, ha, ha, you need to go solve Cryptos, one of the most famous unsolved codes in the world. This is a dead end. And then I went back to solving the rest of the Freaknik 3 code. So that's how I first heard about Cryptos. And then a bit later, this was 24, 25 years ago. And so a bit later, September 11th happened, and I was as enraged as everyone else by what had happened. And I actually have a cousin who works in Washington, D.C., and he had a very close call that morning where he was supposed to give a talk at the Pentagon. And sorry, I'm getting a little upset. He was supposed to give a talk at the Pentagon that morning, and he was running late because he was having printer problems. And he finally got the problems fixed. You know, figured out, and then he was heading for the Pentagon, and he was checking his cell phone, and his phone actually crashed because of all the messages that were on the phone saying, a plane just hit the Pentagon, don't go. And the plane actually hit where he was supposed to be. So some of the people that he was supposed to brief were actually killed that morning. So, you know, we fast forward another few months, and it was, I think it was Thanksgiving. And I flew to Washington, D.C. to see my cousin and hug him. And we went to the memorial. It was a very new memorial. You could still smell smoke and stuff. But we went to the we went to the Pentagon. We put a little American flag there, and then we were driving around, and it was my first time in Washington, D.C. And so my cousin, Nick, he was saying, well, it's your first time in D.C. Is there anything else you want to see now that you're here? And I'm like, well, you. And he says, well, that's a nice, you know, it's nice to see you, too. But there's kind of a lot of things to see. Anything else you want to see? And I'm like,
it's like, how good is your security clearance? There's something I want to see.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And I said, you know, I've heard about this sculpture called Kryptos at CIA headquarters. I'd like to go see it. And he said, okay, well, let's see, CIA headquarters, that's in Langley. And so we tried to find it, and we just failed miserably because there's no street address for CIA headquarters. You can't just – and at the time, MapQuest, you couldn't type it into MapQuest and say, take me to CIA. So I wasn't going to let that stop me. So I went looking on at the time, we didn't have Google Earth, but we had other ways that you could kind of see from above different areas of the city. And I sort of knew what the CIA looked like because I'd seen Tom Clancy movies. Okay. You know, they'd get this thing, you know, CIA, like, yeah. Dee-dee-dee-dee, you know, CIA.
That's the real building.
Yeah, exactly. So I got some of these pictures, and I went and I looked for the CIA and found it. And then I had the general location of it, and then there's these things called Operation Security and ComSec and Communication Security, and people failed miserably because I was Googling, and I would find, like, someone had said, okay, I'm giving directions to my son's soccer match. The way to get there is you drive down the highway, and after the sign to the CIA, you're going to take the next exit. And so, like, okay, here's where we go. So my cousin and I, we went there, look, there's a sign to the CIA. And what we were intending to do, totally naive, what we were intending to do was to go to the CIA and then just, like, see if there was, like, a service road around the outside, and we'd peek over the wall, you know, and see if we could see the crypto sculpture. It doesn't work like that. You get there and you take the exit, and there's big walls with barbed wire across the top and guard shacks with big guys with guns that are pouring out, asking a very reasonable question right after September 11th. Yeah. Who are you and why are you here? Right, exactly. So
have a gift shop there.
exactly. So my cousin and I are like, can we talk our way into CIA? So we're like saying, oh, we're just here to see Kryptos. And the guards relaxed a little bit and said, sorry, official business only. And we're like, okay, can I get my congressman to send an invite so we can get in? And they said, sorry, you know, official business only. And we're like, is there a public tour day so we can come in and see? And they're like, sorry, official business only. And no matter what we asked, they were like, sorry, official business only. And like I said, these were big guys with guns. And so we finally said, okay, and we drove away. So now there's another part of my life that's going on at the same time of this. By the way, I'm totally over time. Can I keep going here?
Yeah, I think we still got another five.
Okay. So I'll see if I can condense this a little bit. So there was another part of my life that was happening where I had September 11th. I'm furious as everyone else by September 11th. And I was wondering, could I help with the war on terrorism? So if you think back, nothing we remember personally, but back in World War II, there was this area called Bletchley Park, where people were helping with the war effort and cracking the Enigma ciphers. So if you've seen the movie The Imitation Game, right? And they needed a lot of people. And one of the things they would do is they would put puzzles into the newspaper and say, if you can solve this puzzle, come and join the war effort. This really happened, okay? And I was wondering, like, I've cracked all these codes in the hacker scene, you know, the Freaknik 3 code and this stuff. Maybe I can help with the war on terrorism. So I called up my local FBI, and I said, hey, can I help? And they said, no. So, okay, not going to stop me. What can I do? So, I kept calling back saying, can I help? And finally, I got an agent who said, well, what is it that you know about? And I said, oh, well, I know about all these codes. You know, I can do in the Freaknik 3 code, there'd been this thing like UU encoding and steganography and Morse code. And he says, wait, steganography. We've been hearing rumors that Al-Qaeda might have been using steganography as a way of planning the September 11th attacks. Maybe you could use steganography. You could come in and give a talk about steganography to us, because we're here in the St. Louis office. And cryptography is not our mission. That's like the Washington, D.C. thing.
What is steganography?
Aha. So steganography is a way of hiding messages in a way that it's not clear that there is a message. So remember I was talking about cryptography is like hidden and writing. So steganography is writing, but it's writing under a roof, like Stegosaurus is a lizard with a roof, right? So steganography is a way of sending a message that it's not clear that there even is a message.
You know, like the fourth word has the first letter of every fourth word will give a message, kind of like that simple?
It could be. Most commonly, it's something where you're looking at a picture, and inside the bits and bytes of the picture, there is a message that's hidden in the picture. So you could be looking at a picture of a rose, but inside that picture of a rose, you have an entire document that's hidden inside that picture.
How long have you been cracking codes for?
Well, I've been cracking recreational ciphers since I was a kid. Like, I'd buy these crossword puzzle books that would have crossword puzzles at the front and codes at the end, and I would just ignore all the crossword puzzles and just go to the codes at the end and the logic puzzles, because that's what I was interested in. And then it was Dragon Con with the Freaknik 3 code, and I was like, okay, I'm going to crack this now. And that's when all of a sudden I started getting public attention for having cracked the Freaknik 3 code that no one else had ever cracked. And it was funny, because when I got to the center of it, the guy who had written the code had not made any assumption that a woman might be the person who would crack the code. So at the center of the Freaknik 3 code, it said, congratulations, now to announce your win, you need to write a message in haiku or sonnet format about why you like to go swimming with bow-legged women and swim between their legs, which is an old World War I song. Yeah. And I was like, what the? And I wrote a haiku. The guy who had written the code was a guy named Johnny X. That was his handle. And so I wrote a haiku, which, as you know, is 575, right? And I said, Johnny X and I will discuss things aquatic if he wears a suit. And so that was how I announced my win. And it took him a month to respond, but he finally grudgingly did, saying, okay, Ilanka has cracked the code. So, and then that got me all kinds of attention. And then I went around cracking a bunch of other codes in the hacker scene. I actually cracked so many that I was banned from competition. So like at the AtlantaCon hacker convention, when they released their code, it was on a sheet of paper. And at the bottom of the paper, it said, note, past puzzle solvers are ineligible for prizes associated with solving the AtlantaCon puzzle. Give someone else a chance. Ilanka.
You get too good at being an amateur, then you got to go professional.
So I cracked that one, too.
I think we got to bring this in for a landing. So how can people follow you, find your books, check out all the things that you do?
Sure. I have a personal website, ilanka.com. And for our book here, we have a website, because I wrote this with Klaus Schmeh, who is a big crypto blogger in Germany. And our website is codebreaking-guide.com.
Awesome. Well, thank you for your time. This has been immensely educational, and enjoy the rest of your con. Any final words for me?
Yeah. I'd be happy to keep talking for hours. I will be giving here at Dragon Con later today. I'll be giving a talk on Kryptos and other unsolved codes, and then tomorrow I'll be giving a talk on Crypto 101, which is how to crack codes, and then on Monday I'm giving a talk about two big codes that have been cracked recently and how they were cracked. And one is the Zodiac Killer ciphers, and the other is the cipher. There were a bunch of letters by Mary, Queen of Scots, that were just discovered and decrypted. And I'm going to talk about how that whole thing happened on Monday.
Sounds awesome.
It really is. And that's... nobody has a real model of what a space battle is going to look for. So what you really get is what they want to write about, which is pirates and swords. It's what I always want to write about, is pirates and swords. Or David Weber was writing about the French Revolution. So he wrote the end of the war with England and the French Revolution. He just used space battleships and missiles instead of cannon. And his first book, the first Honor Harrington book, is absolutely the same as what's the name of the book? The Captain, Master and Commander.
Yeah.
You spend freaking 400 pages getting to know her crew, and 30 seconds blowing them away. Oh, which just, I am very empathetic, so sometimes I tear up a bit. It's nothing. Don't be alarmed. It just happens to me.
That series really should have taken off, the movie series.
Master and Commander? Yeah. Oh, God, yeah.
Well, we kind of jumped straight in the conversation, so without an introduction. So let's pause and introduce who we're talking to today.
Hi.
We're here with Hawkins Austin, author and many other official things.
I'm the average author, historian, scientist, LARPer. I've done a few things. Of course, I'm not a kid anymore. Yesterday was my birthday. I'm 57. I've been doing all of this all the time. And so, yeah, I really am everything. We were going to start with science.
Yeah, let's start with the what's your current, well, they're both real jobs, but your non-fictional job.
What am I doing today? So I work for a company that builds spaceships. We build satellites. Part of our work was on the Orion. So we literally build spaceships. Mostly I do computers. I test computers. I build boards to test computers for the rigors of space. I am a radiation effects engineer, and I have done survivability, radiation effects, and written a lot of requirements since. I guess I got in the field in 96, got hired by NASA, and I didn't expect to get in that field. I have 4 degrees in fire. I expected to be doing something involving fire. I got a master's in plasma physics. I've got degrees in thermal engineering. I am was a fire expert. Now I'm 40 years out of date. That's irrelevant, but and I got into it, and Jim Howard taught me the ropes, and since then I have been in radiation and survivability, and I'm considered one of the experts. I hate to say that. I'm the kid. So you got to realize that this field was formed back when they started weapons testing back in the 70s, and all those guys are old now. I like to say that the guy who put in my favorite device is an X-ray flash source they have over at in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and I use that all the time. And the guy who taught me how to do that, when he was a lieutenant, he installed that source in 1967.
It was like in the Wild West days where it's like, let's just drop a nuke in the desert.
Yeah.
I'm hoping things have gotten safer since then.
They have a table there, and I'm not kidding. They have a table there, which I thought was unusually large, and the guys looked over at me and said, yeah, it can fit a cow. And I went, why would you have a cow? And they looked at me and said, we have had cows on this table. And I'm like, okay, you know what? This is a conversation I clearly do not need to know.
I presume that's a dead cow where they were testing radiation?
No, they were testing radiation effects on living creatures. They're military, and Kirkland has done, human effects of radiation. I don't do human effects anymore. I do electronics. I prefer to not deal with killing people. One of my least favorite jobs was a war gamer. So there's a job we did where we came up with scenarios, and there's a very simple test that they give captains who are going to become admirals, and they give them their log books. So they own a fleet. They're in a conference room, and there's 20 or 30 of the guys in there, depending on the year, and their crew, which is usually about a dozen guys that they've worked with for decades, and they're given a set of missions, which could include war or anything else, and they're trying to do these missions, and literally they look up, they flip pages in the logbook and go, all right, we're going to launch a strike, so that means I call this guy, I do this, and they read through the pages of what they're supposed to do. And at 4:20 p.m., I walk in and say, you have lost connection with Pacific Command. And And they're like, oh, that can't happen. And it can't happen unless somebody dropped a nuke on Pacific Command. So I have to work out all the fatalities and the casualty lists, and we try to work through how they're going to, what do they do? And not have a breakdown. I go home and have a shot of scotch because it's a very emotional day to sit in there and try to figure out what kind of decisions people are going to make with literally hundreds of thousands of lives on the line.
Yeah, it's kind of that having to think on your feet, but then also if you make the wrong decision, and even if you make the right decision, there's going to be fatalities. Yeah.
There's no good answers when there's a nuclear war in sight. And so that I found a little bit, shall we say, overly stressful. One of the reasons I wrote the requirements for space warfare, literally did. I worked for the guy who's who got to sign it, but I did the and I hired people who did the real work. I don't want to give myself too much credit for typing in numbers that other people give me, but I wrote those requirements, and I was a little uncertain that Haydn and a few others wanted to do some things with commercial cots that I thought was inappropriate. And so I used my secret techniques and found out who was building the boards for Haydn, etc., and applied for work there. Yeah, this is kind of on the edge of not exactly appropriate. But anyway, because I wanted to find out how they were going to do it and what they were doing, and I interviewed their guys because they were interviewing me. And some of them were really good, and some were, I was impressed by Eric. He had actually worked at one of the prompt dose facilities I knew. And so I had some idea, and they were really worried about the that bastard in D.C. and what he was doing with requirements. And so they hired that bastard in D.C. So I came to Denver, and I worked in Denver for the last 5 years, making sure that our spacecraft that do military things are not going to die on orbit, no matter who throws a nuke at them. Hmm. Mind you, now, none of these have people on board. The Orion mission, which I did work on, and that system is just as hard, and it has there's a cute story there, but jumping back, that one has people involved. Most of my systems for military are the slower, harder systems. What we built for Orion has one of our giant FPGA boards, and you don't need to know what that is, but let's just say it can hold several personalities which are running the software. So you design it around, you know, here's a digital processor, and here's docking cam, and here's a couple of things, and so you turn the dial, and literally you're loading different software, firmware they call it, and then, okay. Turns out that their good hard computer that they designed to do all the rest of the mission was so slow and ineffective that they went ahead and put all the software on our computer and let our computer run the whole mission because it ran it much better, and we decided the whole three personalities weren't necessary as big as our FPGA was, so it ran all three personalities at once, and in fact ran the entire mission, and now the main flight computer is a backup.
What are building, other than, like I said, a desk, what's the kind of difficulties people don't think about when building a computer to operate in space versus something here?
So the
here?
First one, and I literally, this is the first lesson I teach when I teach. When they design, you assume it's going to work, and you design something like, you know, a cell phone, and why would it not work? Stop. It's gonna stop. It's gonna break. You're gonna be on orbit, and it's gonna fail. Now, what do you do next? Does it have a full reboot system that says, oh, hey, the computer's not working. Let's start it over from the beginning. Ah, it's not reaching its first waypoint. Let's reload the waypoints. Let's get it all back in together.
You tried unplugging it and plugging it back in.
Right, exactly. And no IT guy is going to go up on orbit and do that. So you have to set that up so that if everything fails, it decides to call home. And it doesn't wait on somebody to come up there and touch it because no one ever will again. And designing a system that is self-sufficient from the ground up. So if you had, if it was your laptop, it would automatically go, huh, man, this program isn't working well. I'm going to reboot this program for you. Now let me insulate it into a separate area. I've rebooted it. Is it clean? Is it working okay? Does it pass the checks that you wrote up? We wrote a full test series. Okay, it passed those tests. I'm going to allow this software to work, this hardware to go again. Does it work? Okay, it's finished our check sequence. Now we can go back to normal operation. So you have to have an oversight system designed for everything, even the oversight system. And so, yeah, it's a redundancy all the way back to, I mean, at some point you've got an MRAM, which is a giant chunk of crystal, which can't possibly be upset or die. And it's got an ASIC cut that will reload this little FPGA that will restart everything. And that's my third in the sequence. And so I've been doing this work since 96. I'm good at it. Good at the military level or at the human level. It's hard. But honestly, the problem most people have is that they trust a bunch of college students to figure it out, or a really smart guy to figure it out. And honestly, while being smarter than me wouldn't be hard, it doesn't get you to the answer. The answer is, what is the last 50 things that have gone wrong with the system like this? Let's go back and see which of those are going to happen to our system. And we're not going to expect it. So expect everything. Anyway, the more I get involved in the program, the more they end up doing redundancies, and they hate me. So they try to keep me out until such point as they realize they need about 6 more redundancies.
Sitting around trying to think of what's all the things that can go wrong. Just pre-planned for all the contingencies having contingencies.
So I have one other advantage that they don't have, is I'll take the system that supposedly works, and I'll take it over to a radiation environment like a proton gun, and I will break it. And I will write up all the interesting ways that it dies horribly in orbit. And then send that back to their programmers and their hardware designers. And they're like, but this can't happen. I'm like, yes, clearly it can. Here's the logs. Here's the run logs. I did that. And they're like, I guess we should have a meeting on. Yeah, okay, we'll fix this. Anyway.
And then they fix it and shoot it back to you, yeah?
I rarely get them a second time. There's a few military programs where I've spent 5 years with a board. And that one I did. 4 years with a board. And in the end, we did the most ridiculous task that has never been done before. I took a functioning satellite system, thump, 250 pounds of what's supposed of a box. It's a big, giant aluminum box, 50 cables coming out of it. Had to shield all those cables, and then I shot that box.
With radiation?
Yes. With a giant, it's called the short pulse gamma. It's a little facility that they have on the West Coast. And they use a 6 MeV gamma rays, and it will, they're technically X-rays, but blow right through the box. Aluminum's essentially transparent to it.
So with all of this talk about space weapons, is the Space Force thing that DC has been talking about, is that a bunch of hooey, or is that something that can really happen and make a difference?
So the most exciting thing there, and I'm sure this is not interesting to anyone else in the universe, they've developed a new funding mechanism for the SDA, Space Defense, and that's part of Space Force. And the funding mechanism allows them to go to small vendors like Seeker and look for and build satellites. Now, Lockheed and Raytheon bought various companies, including my own, to try to get this power inside their own walls. And they have succeeded mostly. But the trick is we're running out. There'll be 85 satellites in a network. They'll use lasers to communicate with each other, and you will have instant communications for the military across, instant light-speed communications across the globe of gigabit size, so you can take images, tracking for reasons you might want to image and track something, okay? Fine. I don't want to get into that too deeply, but it'll be transported to a cute little room somewhere in Albuquerque, New Mexico. There'll be a guy sitting at a desk, and he'll be watching this object they're tracking in whatever country it might be in, and it'll be all over. And that's what Space Force is starting with, complete communications. What they're going to move to, complete detection, and then hopefully ways to intercept missiles in space. That's I'd say above my pay grade. I don't have a doubt that it's going to be in my pay grade soon enough, because that's probably what they're going to hire me to do. But
how long, tie-wise, do you think it would be before we get, like, actual, like, military spaceships, not just, you know, the satellites, the observation and detection we're working on?
I wish I knew. Decades, centuries. I would love to be, you know, out there in a space patrol cruiser shooting my lasers. Is it a dream? Absolutely. And I'm going to have armor, and I'm going to have a sword. And, yeah, absolutely. I can't imagine it not being every kid's dream to have their own freaking spaceship. Who wouldn't want one? My characters in the Book of Ramon, they're driven by the concept of getting a spaceship. Oh, 5 minutes? I need to do this 10 times, guys.
Yeah. Well, that kind of leads us into your other career here as an author. Like, what made you run from, like, hard science to fantasy and sci-fi?
So, I don't watch a lot of TV, and I have a lot of hours in the day. Now I have a kid and a wife, and that makes it tricky, but I used to run D&D campaigns. I'm always telling stories. And so when I was less employed between two jobs, my wife said, write one of them up. And so I wrote down The Broken Man, and 2 years later, that got published. And so it was kind of a D&D-based sort of, and I'm also an historian in my great spare time. I read history books as much as anything else. And so I have been studying Irish history, and I brought all that in. And then I just keep, I have so many stories, I keep writing them. And I don't want to go through that. I shared it with you earlier, the whole Mark Center debacle. But I haven't been able to write science fiction for most of my previous employers. And under my current employer, they know and they don't care, as long as I am not touching
proprietary.
If I don't tell their proprietary stuff, they don't care. And they're, mind you, occasionally they'll come out and they'll read my author description at meetings and laugh a lot. So I'm a nutcase. They know that. And they put up with it. I dress in armor and I go beat people with swords. I've got a lot of hobbies.
Yeah, I imagine you spend so much time in real stuff that it's like, the fantasy is like, you got to get completely out of that to, like, you know, rest the brain.
I mean, who really wants to spend their, well, you know what? I know computer geeks who spend their days talking about computers, and I'm a computer geek, and I'd like to talk about fantasy characters and blowing up things, and, you know, let's be geeky and, you know, have a sword fight. I mean, for goodness sake, that's the worst part about spaceships. The chances of there being a real sword fight is real minimal, okay? That's the worst part.
So has your employer ever had to kind of say, don't put that in a fantasy novel because it blurred the line just a bit?
No. On fantasy, even my most critical security advisor, Castle Brave, starts with a security alert, security notice, because I'm a complete geek. And after he had not approved my previous two novels, I sent him Castle Brave's security review. He wadded it up and threw it at me, which tells me it was approved. It's a military-based novel, and it's very related to what we did at DITRA. However, it is completely fantasy, and he doesn't care. As long as I can put in a nuclear weapon, and he does not care, as long as it's a fantasy nuclear weapon. When I start describing how how real ones work, he gets kind of nervous, which I did at one point, which is a mistake in that one. But in Castle Brave, note, not Castle Bravo, I don't describe any actual nuclear weapons. So there, it works.
Who are your books intended for? What age group?
So my daughter's 12, and she can read Pure Poison. It's clean. I don't have a lot of cuss words, and it's but some of the words are a little more advanced. I have trouble reducing my vocabulary. I've been reading since I was I started Star Beast when I was 9. So I've been reading Heinlein since I was 9. I'm not good at figuring out what normal people understand in words. So sometimes my choice of words is not best for a 12-year-old. But as their word at college level, if you can read college level, I don't write anything that nobody can read. I don't put sex scenes in my books. Violence, yes. There is gosh-awful amounts of violence. My books are all entirely people sitting around talking and then lots of violence.
Well, I guess as we kind of bring this in for a landing before they kick us out of here, how can people find you, find your books, plug all your okay. things?
So currently my only publisher is Tuscany Bay. I've outlived three publishers. Tuscany Bay is still doing quite well, and they have Castle Brave and Court Human. The rest of them are on Amazon. I self-published six books on Amazon, and I'm also in LaPont has a collection of short stories called Swords and Maidens, and I'm one of the short stories in there.
Cool. Well, thank you for your time, sir. Have a good con. We'll release you back into the wild.
Thank you.
And you've been listening to the Cigar Nerds Podcast. Check us out on CigarNerdPodcast.com. We're on the ESO Network at ESOnetwork.com. We're on Instagram, Facebook, X, at Cigar Nerd Pod, and we're on YouTube at Cigar Nerd Podcast. Don't forget to like, comment, and subscribe. Get your energy drinks at StrikeForceEnergy.com and get your shirts at RealMenSmokeCigars.com. And with that, peace out. Look out for aliens. And this has been a recording of the Cigar Nerd Podcast with your hosts, Smokin' Joe and Brad Jackson. Join us next time for more adventures in nerddom.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.